Du bist Mitglied der irischen Workers' Party. Du bist ihr Sprecher für den Norden Dublins. Kannst du bitte unserem Publikum kurz vorstellen, wer die Workers' Party ist und wofür sie steht?
So the Workers' Party is a Marxist-Leninist party. In an Irish context, we would say we are a socialist Republican party. And Republican in an Irish context has a specific meaning. It's a tradition that sought to create a united, independent Irish Republic, anti-sectarian, to unite the Irish people around a Republican ideal that goes back hundreds of years. Specifically how we became the Workers' Party, you're probably familiar with Sinn Féin. Our party is, like many parties in Ireland, we all stem originally from Sinn Féin. In the late 1960s, around the time when the conflict, that if you want to call it that, that broke out in the north of Ireland, it was taking place, there was a split in the Republican movement between what was called the official wing, which became us, which wanted to bring more of a Marxist analysis to what was happening in Ireland and essentially emphasize the need to unite the working class and have a united working class in order to bring about a united country, as opposed to what was called the provisional wing, which favored essentially, you know, bring about a united Ireland by force and then we'll worry about uniting the working class later on, or really didn't have a class analysis. So there was a split in the movement, what became called official Sinn Féin, which was linked to the official IRA. And gradually over the 1970s, that moved away from the sort of armed struggle towards becoming a socialist Marxist political organization operating across Ireland, trying to bring about class unity, a focus on class politics. And eventually the name was changed and became known as the Workers' Party. So that's who we are today. And that's still what we are. We're a socialist Republican party that has a Marxist-Leninist view that sort of respects and the tradition of existing socialist states, that has had traditional links to the existing socialist states, and you know, wants to bring back that sort of vision of socialism.
Ende Oktober stand Irland im Mittelpunkt der europäischen Aufmerksamkeit. Mit der Wahl von Catherine Connelly wird eine erklärte Kritikerin von EU und NATO Präsidentin Irlands werden und zugleich eine aktive Verfechterin der Vereinigung Irlands mit Nordirland. Was bedeutet der Wahlsieg von Connelly für Irland, aber auch für die EU? Welche Politik wird Connelly betreiben?
So, it's an interesting question. I think it is important symbolically, and it may be important politically in a broader sense. We have to say, in a immediate terms of executive or legislative power, the president in Ireland does not have executive or legislative power. The Irish president is very similar to the Bundespräsident in Germany. It fulfills a similar role. So Catherine Connolly won't be able directly to bring in a legislative agenda or to doesn't really have the power to block legislation. But the president has become recently quite an important role in Ireland because of it has a high profile, and the president, the last president, in fact, the last two or three presidents have used the office to promote their social agenda, or to some extent, Michael D. Higgins, the outgoing president, has used it to promote on the international stage an international view of geopolitics, which probably reflects the majority view of the Irish population much more than what the actual government tends to do. So in recent years, there has been a tendency for the president to reflect a popular view, which is tends to be more in favor of neutrality, a little bit more opposed to NATO, opposed to EU militarization. And that has gone against the position of the government that's in power, which is very much aligned with, which is strongly neoliberal, completely aligned with the EU agenda, and essentially just attempts to mediate between the EU and the US. So Catherine Connolly is again a further step on that road. She has expressed publicly, you know, a line that's very skeptical of NATO, a line that's quite skeptical of the EU. She's associated with people like Claire Daly and Mick Wallace, who have been completely vilified in the Irish media. There's a blanket campaign across all Irish media to brand them as, you know, Russian traitors, Russian spies, etc. And Catherine Connolly is very much associated with that wing of Irish politics, perhaps less had less high profile before. So the fact that she has resisted, overcome this smear campaign, there was across the board attempt by all the mainstream media to brand her as being a threat to our national security, a threat to our position in Europe, somebody who will be damaging to our economy, damaging to our international standing. She was accused of being, a lot of talk about the fact that she quite rightly went as part of a parliamentary delegation to Syria and met with Assad and was in favor of ending the war in Syria as opposed to what we've eventually seen. She was attacked relentlessly for these things, and that attack has failed. She won very convincingly in the election. And it reflects the fact that there is a real disjuncture between the position of the mass of the Irish people and the position of the government on these issues. So it's it's potentially very significant that she has won, but that won't take the form of her being able to enact her own policies, unfortunately. But it does mean that it is going to force the government that's in power in Ireland to take into account the fact that their position and the line they're pursuing is increasingly at odds with the mass of the people.
Um das für unser Publikum deutlich zu machen, die Republik Irland ist Mitglied der EU, aber nicht der NATO. Militärische Neutralität gehört zu den Grundsätzen der irischen Außenpolitik. Aber stimmt das überhaupt noch? Immerhin nimmt Irland seit 1999 am NATO-Programm Partnerschaft für den Frieden teil, hat sich beteiligt an NATO-Einsätzen im Kosovo und in Afghanistan. Steht Irland wirklich noch für Neutralität?
Well, as I was saying, to continue what I was saying, I think the bulk of the Irish people, of course, politically we have massive class distinctions and so on, but the bulk of the Irish people, and particularly the bulk of the Irish working class, absolutely support neutrality, and I think quite a positive version of neutrality, support the idea of Ireland having a positive role outside, on the world stage, as we might have done in the past, having more sympathy with the global south and the post-colonial nations due to our own history. The Irish government, the governments that have been in power, unbroken power for the last, well, in a way for the last century, but certainly during the last kind of post-Cold War era, we've had an unbroken series of neoliberal governments in power. They absolutely have no interest in maintaining the principles of neutrality and the principle of that positive neutrality at all. They essentially have attempted over a course of maybe 20 or 30 years to reduce neutrality to a mere very technical distinction, and that is that we are not a full member of any military alliance. But in every other way, they've sought to ally us with NATO, with EU militarization, and to signal as clearly as possible that Ireland is not in any way a roadblock or does not in any way oppose NATO, the EU-NATO alliance. And in fact, they often refer to NATO and to the other Western countries as our allies. So in effect, it's very hard to say that Ireland is really neutral. But the principle of neutrality is still held very strongly by a majority of the people. And so the government has attempted to gradually undermine it, to weaken it, to pick away at everything except for this one single fig leaf, which is that we won't actually explicitly join NATO. But, it's not necessary for NATO. It's not necessary for the Western US-EU alliance for you to fully become a member of NATO. They can get everything that they need from us without us becoming a full military member. Ireland has no military capabilities to speak of anyway, so there would be no actual value in us joining NATO. What matters is that they have full access to Irish waters, to the information, whatever information gathering powers the state has. They can use Ireland as a waypoint to move troops and weapons back and forth, and that geopolitically in the UN, in the EU, Ireland won't act as any sort of block or attempt to use exert any sort of soft power to block militarization. But the disjuncture between that neoliberal approach of the ruling class and the actual opinion of the mass of the people is getting broader. So the reason this is a real has become a very important issue at the moment, if you don't mind me just talking, is there's first of all, the context, of course, is the war in Ukraine, the push towards creating EU-wide military structures. Ireland has always had, you know, quite explicitly insisted on not that membership of EU military structures is not a part of a requirement of EU membership. And the current government is attempting to undermine that principle. So if we go back to 2001, when the Nice Treaty came in, Ireland is one of the few countries that requires a referendum on European treaties. So every European treaty is approved by the government, but then it requires a vote of the whole electorate to approve it. Ireland voted against the Nice Treaty. And one of the main reasons that Ireland actually voted against the Nice Treaty was the move towards creating a common defence policy in the EU. And we were essentially told to go back and vote again until we got the right answer. But the promise that was given, and there was a declaration that accompanied the Nice Treaty, a national declaration, made very clear that there was no obligation for Ireland to participate in any military structures and any common defence, that it was understood that our neutrality would be unaffected by that participation. Again, a few years later with the Lisbon Treaty, Ireland again voted no to the Lisbon Treaty. Again, we were told to keep voting. And again, neutrality was an issue, and it was repeatedly assured that there would be no obligation, that membership of the EU did not in any way entail an obligation to participate in a common defence, to join any larger military structures. In the last few years, particularly with the war in Ukraine and the whole EU transitioning to a war footing directed against Russia, as we're now being told, and ironically, many of the very same government ministers who negotiated those original guarantees in 2001 are now coming and telling us, well, you can't be a member of the EU and not participate in common defence. It's our duty as EU citizens to participate in a common defence, and are attempting to roll back those guarantees. So that's the important broader context. The specific legal situation in Ireland is that there's what's called the triple lock on military involvement, which you don't need to know all the details, but the essential point is that Ireland can't send troops abroad on any mission that doesn't have a UN mandate, a mandate from either the Security Council or the General Assembly of the UN. And in the last few years, particularly since the war in Ukraine, there has been a very broad campaign across all the mainstream media to undermine this. The government is moving legislation to try to remove it. And the claim is, well, Russia has a veto over our foreign policy. Because Russia has a veto in the Security Council, that means that Russia can determine our foreign policy, and this is unacceptable. Of course, I mean, the idea that Ireland would undertake any independent military action is ludicrous. We have no military capabilities to speak of whatsoever. So really, the problem with the triple lock is that it is a legal block from Ireland participating in NATO missions which do not have a UN mandate. The Irish people are very happy with this situation. The thing that prevented the Irish government from involving Ireland in the war in Iraq, for example, which they would have done, was that there was no UN mandate. And without the UN mandate, they were not able to engage in the war in Iraq. They found other ways to help, but they weren't able to send Irish troops to Iraq. And they would have liked to do that to curry favour with the Americans, but were unable to do so. And the Irish people are generally very happy with that situation. But there is an attempt currently to remove that. And there is legislation working its way through the parliament to try to remove the triple lock. And again, the basis is that supposedly Russia and China are nefariously exercising a veto over our freedom to send to go and invade Syria or whatever they imagine we might do otherwise if we didn't have the triple lock. And to go back to the original question you asked, Catherine Connolly has been a very strong supporter of the triple lock, of maintaining the supremacy of the UN and international law, that an international mission is not, under international law, you can't justify military intervention or the sending of troops without a UN mandate as a minimal principle. And she's been a defender of that. So one of the reasons why her election is significant is that among the very minimal powers that the President of Ireland does have, they can potentially block legislation that they think may be unconstitutional, or may potentially refer it to the courts or to a referendum if it's unconstitutional. And there is an argument, a narrow argument, that removing the requirement for UN mandate maybe could be argued to be unconstitutional in Ireland. So there is a potential, it's unlikely, but there's a potential for her as president to block or to stymie that sort of legislation, which is part of the reason why the ruling class in Ireland, which is completely allied to Brussels and tied to Washington and to Brussels, is so opposed to her taking the presidency.
Bei Kritikern geht die Befürchtung um, mit Connelly erhält Irland eine Präsidentin, die sich aktiv für die Wiedervereinigung mit Nordirland einsetzen wird. Hältst du das für realistisch? Ist diese Vereinigung überhaupt noch eine lebendige Vision in der irischen Bevölkerung?
I mean, it very much is. Of course, you have to take into account the fact that the border, unfortunately, has been real for a long time. There is far less interaction across the border than there would be in the normal functioning of a united country. But I think it's undoubtedly the majority of Irish people still seek reunification. They've asked, do you favour a united Ireland? I think a vast majority of people in the country will say yes. In the north, an overwhelming majority of people who are from the traditionally, what we would call traditionally nationalist background or traditionally Catholic background, would absolutely favour unification. Of course, the traditionally unionist, in other words, people who feel themselves to be more British, will tend to still oppose, but actually their numbers, as a proportion of the population in the north, their numbers are lower than they have been. The demographics have shifted, so there's possibly now, arguably for the first time, a majority in the north of Ireland that favours reunification. Although the answer depends very much on how you ask the question, so you have to take that a little bit with a pinch of salt. But certainly in the north, the demographics and the political balance has shifted towards favouring a united Ireland. In the south, it has always been essentially the stated position of, I think, every party in the country that they favour a united Ireland. The question is whether they really care about it. Is it actually something that's important to them? And for the majority, and certainly the mainstream parties, the parties that are in government, it's not an important issue. It's not something that they really want to tackle. It would be a difficult issue. It would bring problems. They like to talk a lot about the potential economic costs of reunification as a way of saying to people, well, really, you know, do you really want to pay extra taxes to have to reunify the country? But I think, broadly speaking, the bulk of the people still absolutely favour united Ireland, but it's not, I suppose, it's not at the top of their minds or a priority for the bulk of people in the south, to be honest. As I think, from our point of view as the Workers' Party, and our origin is in the Republican movement seeking to unite the country. I mean, our position has always been with regard to the national question that, and this goes right back to James Connolly, the sort of founder of the Irish socialist movement. He said, you know, you can change the flag over Dublin Castle, you can bring down the British flag and raise an Irish flag, but if you don't gain economic control, if you don't have the control of the working class over the economic resources, the industry of the country, what have you really gained? You know, you can change the flag, but you won't really change the power structure. We would still very much ascribe to that analysis. You know, in order to have a united Ireland, a meaningful united Ireland, what we do need to do is firstly to have unity of the working class, which we have sought but have not achieved for a long time. But we also need to ensure that, you know, if we have an opportunity to transform the country by uniting it, we can't miss it. We can't simply say, well, we're going to take down a British flag in the north and raise an Irish flag and allow the current neoliberal regimes on both sides of the border to simply continue or to merge. You know, it's really important that we seize the opportunity to use it in a transformative way. Whereas I think some people who are pushing for a united Ireland now, to have a vote now, to bring it about as quickly as possible, really the focus is on, you know, let's just get the vote through. Let's have the political victory. Let's change the, pull down one flag, pull up the other, and we'll worry about the social structure. We'll worry about the class analysis. We'll worry about changing our economic situation after the fact. And that's a mistake we've made before that we probably shouldn't make again.
Wie lebt es sich in einer geteilten Nation? Sehen sich die Iren als ein Volk, das nur in zwei Staaten lebt, oder sehen sich die Nordiren zunehmend als Briten?
I mean, that's a very complicated question, but I'll try not to give too long an answer. I think in many ways, and particularly culturally, the majority, vast majority of people in it absolutely think of Ireland as a single people. But there is undoubtedly the effect of having 100 years of partition does mean that there are, particularly among people in the south, among the middle class, the sort of wealthier middle class, there is sometimes a sort of unthinking acceptance of partition that doesn't really consider people in the north, that talks about Ireland meaning only the south of Ireland, that doesn't really consider the different situation in the north. But I mean, undoubtedly, I don't think I've yet to meet a person in the south of Ireland who would meet someone from Belfast and not consider them to be Irish. That's not really something that exists. And of course, in the north, you still have approximately half the population of the north, maybe now slightly less than half the population of the north, that identifies itself as being British. And while proportionally that section of the population is proportionally smaller now than it has ever been before, partly because of demographics, the nationalist or more Irish leaning section of the population has grown faster. The people who are most committed to that position are as entrenched in it as ever. There is perhaps a softening. There is in the north, between the two poles of being absolutely committed to unification and absolutely committed to remaining part of the UK, there is perhaps more of a sort of a soft middle ground, consisting of people whose attitude to the question might be more governed by the economics and by, you know, what will make for an easy life and a nice business environment. So Brexit, for example, had the effect, I think, of softening opposition to United Ireland among people who were maybe came from that tradition of being British, but are more focused on sort of practical material benefits that there might be from a United Ireland. The situation, I don't know how much your audience knows about the situation in the north of Ireland. There was, of course, a sort of an armed struggle that went on. The country was partitioned in the 1920s. There was an armed struggle that went on periodically, and then there was a prolonged period of armed conflict from the late 1960s until the mid-1990s. And that was settled with this Good Friday Agreement. And the Good Friday Agreement essentially created a sort of a government structure in the north of Ireland that requires equal representation from both sides in all the local government structures. And it includes this mechanism whereby at some point in the future, there will be a vote, or there can be a vote, to bring about a united Ireland, and the British government and the Irish government are both bound to respect the outcome of that vote. So at some point, there can be a poll, there can be a vote in the north of Ireland and in the south for a united Ireland, and if there are majorities in favour of it, then it is bound to happen under the treaty. The major problem with that settlement that came about is that it came about to sort of end this period of fighting, and most people agreed that some settlement was better than continuing the violence. But the settlement that we have, it's somewhat similar to the situation in Lebanon, if people are familiar with how Lebanon is governed, which is not very effectively. But there is a government structure in the north of Ireland that essentially creates a zero-sum competition between two sides. The government has to be formed by having equal numbers of representatives from one side or the other. Every sort of piece of legislation that is seen to benefit one community must also be balanced by something that seems to benefit the other community. There's a mechanism called parity of esteem, which essentially reduces any attempt to introduce a social service, to change anything structurally, to change the education system. It has to require that both sides of this divide get equal treatment. And it essentially has had the result of basically completely entrenching this division into the political system instead of lessening it. If you don't identify yourself strongly with one side or the other, you essentially are left out in this settlement. So the political divide has actually strengthened and been reinforced by the Good Friday Agreement, which was designed to sort of end the fighting. So it's an unusual situation in the north of Ireland where the people who are opposed to United Ireland are becoming have only become more entrenched in that position, if possible, over the last 30 years. But they are gradually becoming a minority. So the question is, it seems inevitable, I would say, sooner rather than later, there will be a majority in favour of United Ireland. If a vote happens, it will very likely pass. But the question is, again, you know, how do we, what becomes of that significant minority of people in North of Ireland who are violently opposed to being part of United Ireland? Our party, the Workers' Party, has always favoured an approach which attempted to bring about some sort of class unity between these two, the working classes on these two sides, and try to unite the working class in the North of Ireland as a prerequisite to uniting the country. Although I think that's the right approach, we have to say that we haven't been very successful. So we are still faced with this problem of how do we actually bring about a functioning united country. And our position would be that we need to focus on the foundations of building, an equitable, looking at class politics, looking at the class distinctions, trying to make sure that we can make an argument to those people who are opposed to United Ireland that they will be materially better off, that the working class will be materially better off in a United Ireland than in the UK. And to make that case, we need to focus on making sure that when we bring about a United Ireland, it also is accompanied by that we take the opportunity for political transformation and to build some sort of basis for socialism. When Ireland became independent, when the south of Ireland, I should say, became nominally independent 100 years ago, Eamon de Valera, who became a dominant figure in the politics of the south of Ireland afterwards, he kind of famously is attributed to him that he said in the discussions about the structure of the formation of a new state that Labour will have to wait. In other words, that what matters is that we create a nominally politically independent state, and class politics, the condition of the working class, gaining power for the working class, that will have to wait until after we've got independence. And we would feel very strongly that if United Ireland is coming, as it probably is, we can't make that same mistake again of saying that let's just focus on the colour of the flag and ignore the need to actually bring about some basis for class unity and socialism in the state. We think that that has to be fundamental to whatever we achieve. But to answer the question you did ask, I think a United Ireland is certainly coming in the next, I don't know how long it will be. Will it be 10 years? Will it be 20 years? But it seems very unlikely that we won't have a United Ireland in some point within our lifetimes.
Unmittelbar vor der Präsidentschaftswahl in Irland schlug das britische Militär Alarm. Der britische Admiral Chris Perry behauptete, sollte Großbritannien seinen Einfluss in Nordirland verlieren, böte dies Moskau und Peking eine große Chance zum Einfall. Ein vereintes Irland würde eine direkte Einladung sein für Putin und Xi, um Großbritannien und die gesamte NATO zu bedrohen. Insbesondere die Gewässer zwischen Nordirland und Schottland seien für die britischen Atom-U-Boote von entscheidender Bedeutung für die strategische Abschreckung. Was sagst du dazu? Würde ein vereintes Irland tatsächlich die NATO-Position schwächen?
I mean, I would like to think that a United Ireland would weaken NATO's position. Unfortunately, it seems unlikely. The idea that Britain can't tolerate a neighbouring state which isn't militarily aligned to it is quite interesting. It's certainly not the line they take with regard to Russia. they certainly haven't argued that it's a threat to Russia to have a state on its border which isn't militarily aligned with it. They seem to take that attitude in their own case. I think that these claims that Ireland will be a threat, a backdoor, and so on, they probably shouldn't be taken too seriously. I suspect that what really is happening there is that they're attempting to send a signal to an Irish government to not give in to the pressure from the left, from the working class movement, to take a stronger line against NATO. It's essentially just a warning to the current government in Dublin to stay in line and continue on its current path, which is of integrating with NATO in all but name. And I think that really essentially that's what's being done there as a signal. The reality is that the British Air Force, the British Navy, have free rein in Irish waters and in Irish airspace. They do what they want. The Irish state has no, I think deliberately, has no military capacity to even monitor its own waters or its own airspace, and the Brits are quite happy with that. And again, if we were to have a United Ireland under the same regime we have now, under the same sort of neoliberal system of government we have now, I very much doubt that anything would change. You know, the Irish ruling class would continue to cooperate in every way possible with Britain, with NATO, with the US, except for making that step of nominally actually becoming a member. So I think that that threat is obviously exaggerated, and the reality is that in effect, you know, Britain exerts a significant amount of military control over Irish waters and over Irish airspace in any case. It's funny, it's interesting to note this. Well, I don't know if this will be interesting to your audience, but the current Irish government has recently, you know, become very concerned about our lack of ability to defend our airspace and our waters. And they use this as an argument to say that, of course, we need to join some sort of larger military structure because we're defenseless. Who knows what the Russians are doing? But of course, the people making this argument have been in power unbroken for the last 100 years and have deliberately allowed this situation to arise where essentially, I mean, the Irish Navy only has one ship that can go to sea at any given time. So apparently these people who are extremely concerned about the security of undersea pipelines and cables and so on in Irish waters didn't feel the need at any point in the last 50 years to invest in a ship with a radar system or sonar system that could monitor these things. So I think there's a deliberate sort of there's a deliberate attempt to play up this imagined threat from Russia or from China in Ireland, and to sort of play along with Britain in hyping up this threat as a way to sort of justify an increasing entanglement with the European and British and NATO military structures. It doesn't reflect, I think, a reality, and I don't think these fears are real fears. If they were real fears, the Irish state really feared what was going on in its waters, it would, of course, have built the military capacity to do something about it. And the reality with Britain is that Britain already sends its submarines and its ships patrolling around Irish waters with little interference, and would continue to do so under United Ireland regardless. You know, one of the things that's interesting in Ireland, especially being on the left in Ireland, is as strong believers in neutrality, you know, as we are, you know, there's an argument to say that a country that is genuinely neutral and that wants to have a genuine independent foreign policy must actually have the ability to have, not to have a large military capacity, but have the ability to at least monitor things like its own airspace and its own waters. There's an interesting situation in Ireland that the left, which really favours neutrality, is unwilling to make that argument. So the left essentially says that we don't need to have any, we shouldn't have any military capacity whatsoever. And this tends to play a little bit into the hands of the pro-NATO wing, which says, well, if you don't have any military capacity, then you are a backdoor, you're a fifth column, you're leaving the gate open for our enemies. And so you have to join. So it's actually used as a way, as an excuse to then push our entanglement into these other structures. Possibly we need to, as a socialist movement in Ireland, take more seriously the idea of having a truly independent foreign policy and include, and accept that would include actually having some independent military capacity to remove this apparent need for us to be involved with the Brits. But I think those threats, as I said, are less about a real fear of Ireland being a backdoor and more are about a signal to the Irish government to stay in line and to not think about going too far outside what's acceptable.
Lass uns genauer über die Rolle Irlands sprechen in der Geopolitik. Aus einer historischen Perspektive heraus, aus der Erfahrung der Kolonialisierung durch die Engländer, aus Jahrhunderten der Unterdrückung und des Kampfes um Befreiung. Welche Sichtweise haben die Iren auf die aktuelle Geopolitik? Übernehmen sie die pro-westlichen Narrative? Stützen sie die westliche und insbesondere die US-Hegemonie in der Welt? Oder haben sie mehr Verständnis für die multipolare Welt und für den Befreiungskampf der Völker des globalen Südens und Ostens?
So the answer is yes and no. I mean, it has been the case that Ireland has definitely taken a different, that the Irish people on whole, and even in the past, the Irish government has taken a very different line and has taken a more, if you like, anti-colonial, post-colonial line internationally and played, at times in the past, actually played quite a positive role at a UN level, for example, in creating structures to try to help dismantle colonial rule over the, what we used to call the Third World. That's undoubtedly weakened a bit. But as we talked about at the moment, there is something of a resurgence of that anti-colonial view in Ireland. We did have a strong tradition politically, especially in, among the working class, of what we call the Republican tradition, which linked very neatly into anti-colonial struggles and which saw a connection between Irish struggle against Britain and anti-colonial struggles worldwide. The most obvious way you see that is the strong connection with Palestine. There is, not among the government, not among the ruling class, but among the mass of the people, a very strong, a huge majority of the people are very strongly supportive of the Palestinian right to resistance, not just of the creation of a Palestinian state, but of the Palestinian right to resist occupation through force where necessary. There's huge support for that across the board. And that definitely is a result of this long legacy of it being linked. There has been the Republican movement, whether that was our side or the Provisional IRA or Provisional Sinn Féin, have always made a strong link between the Palestinian struggle and our own struggle. I've always seen them as being similar. And that carries on today. And you see that in the fact that although our government are utterly useless and will make only symbolic gestures, the mass of the Irish people are very, very strongly pro-Palestine. The problem, I suppose, is that in the last, let's say, 30 years, that tradition has weakened also since the settlement, if you like, in the north, the partial settlement in the north of Ireland, where the national struggle has become moved much lower down in people's consciousness, that historical link has weakened. We are, after all, 100 years post the at least nominal independence of the south of Ireland, and we are extremely exposed to the American cultural environment. I mean, I think even more so than in Germany. You know, being an English-speaking country, we swim in a sea of, of American propaganda. Our media is completely dominated by the US, much more so than Britain, as it would have been in the past. You know, the sort of social media culture of young people is completely dominated by American culture, and people tend to adopt, perhaps unthinkingly, but have to a large extent adopted an American, framework for politics into an Irish context. And that obviously perhaps weakens that connection back to the anti-colonial tradition that we would have had in the past. So while you do still see a strong connection in things like Palestine, which remain quite high in the consciousness, when it comes to looking at geopolitics more generally, you know, resisting the vilification of Russia and China, for example, unfortunately, I don't think that Ireland is any better than anywhere else in the Western world in resisting that kind of push, where there isn't a direct connection to our own history, where it's not as obvious, people are just as susceptible as anywhere else to buying into this kind of Western narrative. Certainly the fear-mongering about Russia is as strong here as anywhere, and it's largely accepted across the board. There's a, for example, if we talk about Ukraine in the national media, it is utterly unacceptable. I don't think I've seen a single example of anybody in a national media in Ireland really trying to discuss the causes of the war in Ukraine. It's a topic that's simply not considered fit for discussion in mainstream media anywhere in Ireland. You know, the assumption that that Russia is an aggressive threat to all of Europe is accepted. And I don't think even on the left, you know, on the communist left, the Marxist left, there's obviously much more rational analysis of these things, but even then it's not something that people organize around or would express very openly. And I think we may in fact be the only party that has explicitly said that we hope to see the defeat of NATO in Ukraine, and it's not something that people are comfortable talking about. And again, that's just the complete dominance of the American, we're in an essentially American cultural environment, and it is hard to maintain that space for independent analysis of geopolitics outside of that American framework. So we still do have the legacy, and it's still there in some places, of a connection to anti-colonial struggles. You know, there's certainly more willingness to talk about Irish culture and our own, taking pride in our own history and national identity in a way that is not tied to a kind of reactionary nationalism. There's a positive view of national independence that is progressive, you know, that's still there, that still exists. But as I said, certainly in the post-Cold War era, and especially at the official and among the middle class, the bourgeoisie, there is a total identification with the US and European ruling class. The complete and total, you know, sublimation of the Irish ruling class into that. Mm. There's no concept of trying to maintain any kind of national independence. And that's really helped by being completely absorbed into this American culture.
Welche Ziele verfolgt deine Partei, die Irische Workers' Party? Wo sieht sie Irlands Rolle in der Geopolitik? Als vereinigte souveräne Nation? Als Teil der EU? Als Teil der BRICS?
I mean, we do, obviously, to stick to our history, we do see, you know, a united Ireland, a united independent Ireland that has an independent foreign policy as being our goal. Obviously, the questions of how you create a truly united Ireland, as we've said, it's complicated. It's more than just about changing the flag. With regard to the EU, I mean, we still maintain what you might call an old-fashioned Marxist analysis of the EU and what purposes it serves and whose interests it serves. But we also, I think, we take some pride maybe of being a party that focuses that. Takes a realist and materialist analysis to things. We don't indulge too much in idealism. So although we are not a pro-EU party, we have to also understand that Ireland is not a country that's in a situation where it can simply announce it's going to leave the EU and expect wonderful things to happen. We're very economically weak. We're completely... The economic model of the Irish state is completely tied to essentially being a conduit for American capital into the EU. That is the economic model of the state. And, you know, an attempt to remove Ireland from the EU without having first a major restructuring of the whole economy and a change in the entire economic model would not really be possible. It would simply result in economic collapse. That's a reality. And I think the people who take a realist view of geopolitics also kind of understand that geography is still important, who your neighbours are. You can't just ignore who your neighbours are and where your resources come from. So it's a very difficult situation for Ireland. There's very limited scope for Ireland to have a truly independent foreign policy, let alone an independent economic policy. That is still our goal. And we... I talk quite a lot about the need to start developing structures. Certainly, you know, connections with outside of the EU structures, with the BRICS nations, with China, with all the developing industrial powers in the global south are hugely important. We also have to think about within Europe, how do we begin constructing a sort of maybe parallel structures between European states that allow for economic cooperation outside of the neoliberal straitjacket of the EU, to begin to create something that we could look to move out of the EU and towards that, as opposed to the shoot yourself in the foot approach of trying to leave the EU and then be essentially completely exposed to the economic violence that would ensue from both sides. So it's a difficult situation for Ireland. I don't think, to be honest, that many people, even on the Marxist, the communist movement in Ireland, have engaged too much with the questions of how we would extricate ourselves from the EU, how we would actually go about it in a real sense. And the experience of looking at Britain trying to do it, which has not worked out very well for them. They've essentially had to adopt EU law without having any power over it that they had previously, certainly doesn't seem like a great model. So we have a lot of work ahead of us in trying to map out a path for Ireland outside of the EU. But it certainly involves closer cooperation and developing those links with the Global South. Absolutely.
Liebe Zuschauer, wenn euch unsere Beiträge gefallen, teilt sie unbedingt in den sozialen Medien. Abonniert unseren Kanal und drückt auf die Glocke, damit ihr keine Veröffentlichung von Gegenpol verpasst.